go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. We are joined by our super producer, Casey Pegram, and you are here as well. Thanks for dropping by. Scott, today's episode is this is a pretty fascinating one, and it's about the future, right? Mm-hmm. It's about politics. It's about the unintended, at times, ramifications of sweeping decisions.
Yeah, consequences, you might say.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few. There's a few. And before we really dig too deep into today's topic, though, I do want to bring up something. This is kind of related. It's a listener mail that we received, and it was about the evacuation in Florida during Hurricane Irma. And a listener wrote in, and this is, again, tangentially related, I guess, because it has to deal with Tesla. And that's part of what we're going to talk about today. But it comes from a listener named Ben R. And Ben writes in and says, "Hey, Scott and Ben, I like the podcast. It's one of only two on my subscriptions list."
Go Ben's.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Ben. He says, "Anyway, I just wanted to throw in my 2 cents your way about Tesla's 60-kilowatt model. Essentially, your perspective was similar to the ones I had to play devil's advocate here at work. My favorite line to dish out was, 'I'd like you to give me the name of a modern internal combustion automaker who does not use the same motor with different software and power outputs.'"
Which is a great point.
Well, that is, but that's a little bit different than what we were talking about, I think, because we were talking about hardware in particular. Mm-hmm. This is a software difference, right?
Right.
All right. So, of course, his co-workers couldn't, but he said, "Maybe you guys can. You probably know more about cars, but the point is, Tesla went out of its way to make sure that it did what it could to help its customers in time of need." Well, we agree with that.
Yeah.
We thought that was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Not a point of contention there, I guess, on that one. Instead of positive PR, it gets spun into negative PR because Tesla is keeping me from my motor's real power and range. I didn't know that they did that. Well, we did say that. We did mention that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they do, but he says so does every other automaker, which wasn't mentioned by you or the articles I've seen online. This extends beyond ECUs and TCUs as well. Okay, I'm going to pause here for a minute because I don't think that we're doing an apples-to-apples comparison here. I think what we're talking about is the hardware is installed. The software is there. They're just not turning it on. I understand about the software and ECUs and TCUs that can be upgraded up, souped up a little bit.
Yeah.
You can trick a car into thinking that it's a police version of that car with a little bit greater output, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of changes you could do, and tuners know all about this.
Yeah.
What we were talking about, I think, is the hardware is there. They actually put a 75 kilowatt hour battery into the car and then deprogram it so that it only provides 60 kilowatt hours of power. And that's the difference. I think that it's more like, I'm trying to think of an example, but let's say that you got a car with a V8 engine. And the dealer, the manufacturer, said, "You're only allowed to use 6 of those cylinders, and we're going to turn off 2 cylinders somehow in your car, and that's all you're going to get. And unless you come back to us and pay us $10,000 more or $5,000 more, we're not going to activate those 2 extra cylinders. So you're carrying around, you're in a car with a V8, but you're only getting V6 power."
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the thing that I'm thinking of. Or maybe a fuel tank or something like that. That fuel tank might be a better comparison.
Right. Like the fuel tank maybe is built with, let's just say, a 20-gallon capacity, but unless you pay a premium, you can only use 15 gallons.
Yeah, that's
space.
It. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. It's something similar to that, I guess. And I guess I hope it didn't get too confused for a lot of people, but that was more what we were talking about. But Ben goes on to say that he says he wonders if automakers like the big three were somehow putting here's a little bit of conspiracy, Ben. Somehow putting money behind getting articles out there that highlighted the negative of the story and not the positive. Because, of course, Tesla did help out. I mean, that's something.
Oh, inarguably.
Admirable to do. I mean, to flip the switch and give them, the extra power, the extra range, I guess, to get out of there, as fast as possible. But I don't think there's any kind of conspiracy there, Ben. But he says the company is squarely between you and your car argument doesn't stick either, but I think it does. Unless you're telling me that I can modify my VW to my heart's content without voiding my warranty. Well, okay. Another point, I guess, is that we weren't saying that anything about voiding warranty or any kind of hacks, because right now hacks aren't really available for a Tesla. It's strictly manufacturer determined. you know, what kind of power output you're getting from that battery.
At this point.
Yeah, updates that are sent, you know, to Tesla owners automatically. You know, it's really a pretty slick system. But you right now can't really modify your Tesla that I know of. I haven't heard of any hacks that provide more power or, you know, additional range, that kind of thing.
Write in and let us know if you have heard of one, because I would be fascinated to learn about this. There's another point we have to make here, Scott, which is that in our previous conversation, we had paid due diligence, I think, to the notion of streamlining manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
There is a compelling economic reason to simplify the manufacturing process for the batteries,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Just make one kind of battery and then fix it with software afterwards. And I would say that this is even more important in the case of Tesla, because in many ways they're trying to transform an entire industry. So I don't know if they have the margin to, at this point, make a bunch of physically different batteries of that range. It seems like a smarter, more efficient answer for them to just manufacture the one physical type and then change the settings.
Streamline the process a bit.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily villainous or a conspiracy on their part, but I do completely see how any Tesla owner could be like, what the heck?
Yeah.
Why? It's the same battery. Why are you?
Yeah. Well, I understand that. And Ben, I also understand your point. You're saying that, you know, a lot of manufacturers do give you the same engine with different outputs. And that's, again, a programming issue. It's a software issue.
Mm-hmm.
Modifications that are done at the factory, if you want to call it that, really. It's from the factory. So, you know, it's the difference of, you know, getting the SS model versus the standard model, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
But Ben concludes here by saying, it may sound like it, but I don't own an electric car. I rock an APR Stage 2 Mark 7 Golf R. Well, manual transmission, an Audi S line in VW skin. Oh, pretty slick. I imagine these folks with S3s don't know I'm rocking the same powertrain for 25% discount or more. Nice car.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ben, thanks for the note. I appreciate it. And honestly, don't take this the wrong way. I mean, we're just making our counterpoint that we were talking more about a hardware thing than a software thing, really, I think. It's just frustrating that they equip it with the same hardware and then, you know, change it from the factory only. You can't change that on your own. You can't take it to a tuning shop and have that done.
Sure.
It's just a frustrating situation all around, really.
Well, that's sort of also – that's a larger trend, a sea change in car ownership in general, and it's accelerated in the past few years for sure. The idea of making a car that will forever be serviced by the manufacturer rather than the consumer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a problem. Well, I guess it's a problem for a lot of people. Other people, doesn't really matter. They're going to take it to the dealership anyways. They're going to take it to the local mechanic. They're not going to even attempt to fix anything on their own. But the ones that do, that's an issue. I mean, because you're just unable to do it now.
And it reminds me of when we looked at the cost of a McLaren and how so much of that cost comes from McLaren's very strict rules about how the vehicle may be serviced. And now that we're talking about strict rules, I got to tell you, man, California.
Mm-hmm.
California, beautiful place.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Been there a few times, yeah.
Yeah, you've been there a few times.
So have you.
Yeah, I went recently to Anaheim for a conference. I'd never been in Anaheim before.
Mm-hmm.
I had no this is weird, but I had no idea that Disneyland was also there until a coworker told me, and I just sort of took it for granted that I was in a town that have fireworks every night at like 9 p.m. because I thought that's what people did in California.
That's all of California.
I thought it was just like every town. No, I didn't think it was that bad. But I probably should have clocked that. So beautiful place, beautiful weather, huge state, and a varied state as well. It turns out that California is also an economic giant. If it were its own country, it currently ranks as the sixth largest economy in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So if it were its own country, it would be in this order: the U.S., China, Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom, and then California.
Wow, pretty big.
It's huge, and that means that a lot of the decisions that California makes as a state can have a tremendous and often unpredictable effect on the rest of the U.S. and the rest of the world. And you hipped me to a proposed drastic change in California's auto culture.
Yeah, California is considering a combustion engine car ban. And this is something we're going to talk about today that will happen likely within the next couple of decades. It's not something immediate.
Yeah, you know, it's not tomorrow.
No, it's not tomorrow, but it's something that they are seriously considering. I mean, the state of California is considering banning all combustion engine cars. And it may sound like it's, you know, some crazy idea and there's no way that they can possibly get this through. But as we'll discuss in a moment here, it is something that is entirely possible. Something that is, we'll get to it, but it's, entirely possible because of the Clean Air Act of 1970.
Right. Right.
So it's a real possibility. Now it may, it, again, it sounds a little bit, it sounds a little crazy, doesn't it? That one state out of the 50 would ban combustion-powered vehicles, but it kind of makes sense when you look at the strict the restrictions, I guess, that are on automobiles already in California. The the California Air Resource Board, the CARB group, they've already got some real stringent rules in place for California. In fact, other states have joined that at this point. I think there's 9 other states that have joined California with their same clean air restrictions, but or mandates, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just jump right into it. All right. So, well, you know what? We should state this first, too. This is kind of following in line with other places, too.
Yes. I'm glad you said that. So the Chinese government actually took the lead on this. The government of China is developing a plan to phase out all vehicles that use fossil fuel. And this came about pretty recently. On September 9th, the Vice Minister of Industry and IT told this automotive conference in Tianjin that the government was already planning a long-term strategy to eliminate this and to eliminate combustion engines. And as you can understand, most of the audience was pretty skeptical. You know, Britain and France have also said that by 2040, new cars reliant on petrol or diesel will be illegal. So they're saying they have to be hybrids,
yeah,
or electrically powered or solar powered.
Yeah, just not entirely gas powered or yeah, diesel powered even.
Maybe like a Flintstones thing where you put your feet through the bottom.
Yeah. And they're not the only ones. I mean, there's also Norway. There's India. There's even manufacturers that have jumped on this. Manufacturers that are saying they're going to phase out their internal combustion powered engines. And one of them is Volvo, and Volvo is doing this just 2 years from now. They're beginning their phase out program. And not only them, Volkswagen. Volkswagen is saying by 2030, you'll be able to get electric versions of their entire vehicle line by 2030. So, you know, they'll be, it's not that they're going to completely phase it out of VW, they say. It's just that they're going to have a version of it available. If you want, you know, the gas powered version, you could also get the same vehicle electric if you wanted to. So it's happening. It really is happening. And, the place that I saw this first, I think I saw it in the automotive news first. But then I also found the same thing in Bloomberg. And I'm going to follow along with a Bloomberg article here because there are a lot of good points that are made. The first one here, and boy, this, I don't know. We're talking about who wants this. Who is the one driving this? Who's the one that's saying, this is something that has to happen? And it's not really, right now, it's not coming from the populace. They're not saying, like, this is something that we need to do.
Yeah, this is not like a grassroots voter movement.
No. This is coming from Governor Jerry Brown, and he has expressed an interest in barring the sale of vehicles powered by internal combustion engines. And, the person that, this came through with someone named Mary Nichols, and Mary Nichols is the chairman of the California Air Resources Board that we mentioned before, or the CARB group, as you may have heard it called. She did an interview with Bloomberg in New York recently, and of course, Bloomberg is where I'm getting this from. Bloomberg.com is where you can find the article. And I guess Jerry Brown, I guess, is one of the most outspoken elected officials in the U.S. about the need for policies to combat climate change, and they're talking about replicating the moves that were made by China and France and the UK and Norway, yeah, and India. So, you know, the idea was, hey, if they're doing it, why can't we?
And the governor is really putting the gas on this, according to Nichols. she'd been receiving messages from the governor saying essentially, why haven't we already done something? And his question seems to be, well, if China can do this, then why not California? And from a just a people perspective, number of people, it's a good question. There's sure going to be over time there are going to be less drivers in California than there will in China. That's just the statistic.
Well, of course.
But as we'll see, there are some not quite M. Night Shyamalan level plot twists, but there are some complicating factors in this idea.
Yeah, there's a few things we'll get to, some restrictions that are there, and maybe some surprises along the way too, I think. But here's the thing. If a ban were implemented by automakers like GM or Toyota, they'd be under new pressure to make electric vehicles the standard for personal transportation in the United States. Now, I don't know. That's something that Mary Nichols had said.
Yeah.
Do you think that if a ban were implemented in California, that the automakers as a whole, I mean worldwide, would be pressured to change the way they do things because of just because of California? Now, I know that it's coming along with China and the UK and France.
Sure.
I understand that all that's going on too, but I don't know. They're saying that, you know, this is the most populous U.S. state, right? It's got the biggest population. It's a huge – it's a pretty big consumer of automobiles, new automobiles. And I'll tell you numbers in just 1 second if you're patient for just one moment here. But they're saying that a move like this would – like cast doubts, I guess, on the industry. And they would say, well, gosh, if California and China and France and the UK and Norway and India are doing this and Volvo's kind of jumped onto this and, you know, Volkswagen has as well, you know, maybe the rest of us need to get on board as well and do the same thing. So they're saying it will cast doubts on the future of gasoline and diesel power cars everywhere, like all across the globe. To give you an idea of, you know, what they are a large consumer of automobiles, I guess. That's the way I said it earlier. And of course, battery powered and plug-in cars they've been around since what, the 1800s, the late 1800s or mid 1800s even. But from a sales sense, they're still really in their infancy. Now, this also comes from another Bloomberg article, just a quick take thing, you know, real fast, question and answer type, piece that they put together. And it's about batteries and about Tesla model, the Tesla Model 3, which of course we'll talk about too. But the question was, where are the other electric vehicles? And one of the questions here was, how many electric cars do people actually buy today? So, you know, they're saying that from a sales sense, electric vehicles really still are in their infancy, even though we're 100 years down the road.
Right.
Kind of strange to think of, but Chinese consumers bought about 289,000 EVs last year, which that's more than any other market, by the way. So less than 300,000. That's according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance. And then Europeans purchased about 215,000, and the U.S. consumers only bought about 150,000 new electric vehicles last year. Now, that's compared – get this. This is where the numbers come in. So we said China's the largest with less than 300,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. is around 150,000?
Yeah.
That's compared with 92 million internal combustion vehicles that were sold globally in 2016, and 17.6 million of those – came from the U.S. alone. So that's a huge disparity, I guess.
Right.
So the thing is that and that's the point of this article that I'm looking at is that it seems like all you hear about in the press and all the talk, I guess, is about electric vehicles. But the problem is you're not really seeing the same thing in the showrooms. They're not selling the way that your perception of them might be.
This is a very important point. So we're talking about some of the ripple effects here and some of the facts behind the spin, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So China is inarguably the world's largest car market. 25.53 million cars and light vehicles were sold in the country just last year. Also last year, for comparison, California still has a growing drivership base. The 2 million people signed up for licenses to get on the road.
2 million.
Mm-hmm. And this means that obviously with its market share, any move by China, especially an outright ban, is going to have consequences. But it also makes California's proposition pretty intriguing because you have to wonder how it worked. California already uses already taxes gas at a higher rate than other states,
yeah,
and already has some incentives, I guess, to allow for alternative energy.
Sure. You know, in addition to the federal incentives.
In addition to the federal incentives, the U.S. car makers have already started responding to this move that started in China and inspired the governor of California. More GM brand cars, for example, are sold in China than are sold in the U.S.
Hmm. Okay.
And GM, you know, has – they also have their own offerings in the alternative energy market, like the Chevy Volt. But they're hitting back and they're saying, look, it's not going to happen. You know, it can't happen super quickly.
Well, here's the thing is, auto manufacturers, they may be kind of, you know, trying to adjust, trying to modify what they do, what they produce, what they output. But the problem is that for manufacturers right now is that essentially they have to give them away to meet emissions requirements in California. So the California thing is a real sticking point for them because
right.
I think read somewhere that GM said that they anticipate losing as much as about $9,000 on every Chevrolet Bolt that leaves the showroom before the sales even begin. And Fiat Chrysler CEO, what's his name, Sergio Marchionne, he said 3 years ago that he hoped nobody bought the Fiat 500e electric car because every time he sells one, it costs him $14,000.
Holy
shit. So they lose 14 grand for every Fiat 500e electric car that they sell. So he's like, well, here it is. I'm putting it out in the marketplace because, you know, we're doing our part, but please don't buy it because it's tanking our company.
And I feel like there's this opposition to, you know, top-down government mandates by a lot of auto manufacturers. I've got a quote here. Mary Barra, the chief executive at General Motors, on in September, reacting to the statements of China, and this is slightly before the California stuff came out, she said, I think it works best when instead of mandating, customers are choosing the technology that meets their needs.
Hmm.
So she's thinking – this is more of an argument for a buyer's market, you know?
Yeah.
Like if electric vehicles are the best choice, then people will go with them instead of being told they have to. But of course, you know, without – I don't mean to say this in a derogatory way, but the Chinese government's relationship with the Chinese citizens is in many ways based on mandating what people have to do.
Well, absolutely. It's a communist nation. That's the way it works. So, you know, for California to say, we're going to mimic what, or if China can't do it, why can't we? It's because they've got that iron fist, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the deal. All right. So, all right. It's an ambitious goal, really. I mean, the ambitious goal is that, California wants to cut carbon dioxide emissions by 80% from 1990 levels by 2050. So that's, kind of driving this whole issue is that, you know, the idea to reduce, emissions from on-road transportation. So we're not even talking about, you know, the boats in the harbor. We're not talking about the lawn equipment that people use. We're not talking about, you know, the motorbikes that the kids ride, you know, the mini bikes and stuff, the ATVs.
Uh-huh.
We're not talking about, airplanes. We're not talking about any of that. So we're just talking about on-road transportation, you know, the trucking industry. We're talking about personal vehicles. We're talking about work trucks, things like that. But to reach this, they pretty much have to replace all combustion with some form of renewable energy by around 2040 or even 2050. So they're trying to use that as a starting point, you know, as a way to move the discussion forward that they have to do this is because they've set this mandate in place that by 2050, again, they have to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by 80% from 1990 levels. That's pretty tough to do.
Yeah.
Now I know 1990 it wasn't nearly as clean as it is right now. I mean, we're getting there. It's just I don't know. That seems like a pretty serious ramp up to me. It seems pretty difficult to do. Now the question becomes: can they legally do this as well? And we had talked about just for a brief moment. We talked about the 1970 Clean Air Act, which actually goes back to 63, I think it is, when the first one was enacted, mm-hmm. at least in the United States. And it has been, updated. It's been changed over the years. But the rules, from this 1970 Clean Air Act are underpinned by waivers granted by the U.S. EPA. And the thing is that they probably wouldn't use the waivers that are granted by the EPA to do this because they think that the current Trump administration would probably be unlikely to approve one at this point.
Right.
But they said they could go around it. There's another way around it to use different authorities to do so. And the idea would be to use vehicle registration rules or even control the vehicles that are eligible or have access to state highways. So, there's ways to enforce this or police this without necessarily getting the U.S. government involved. They just would do it through state government, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
But it is – I really appreciate that you pointed out how it's a how it's a dicey political issue because mm-hmm. this clean air waiver was already an issue before the current governor, declared his plan,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's no secret that the current administration or members of the current administration would like to revoke that waiver, which would have impacts incredibly significant impacts on California's current plan mm-hmm. for reducing emissions. And because the Clean Air Act is one of those things that has such wide-reaching effects and has been around for so long, it's one of those things that will show up in the news and then disappear and kind of move in a cycle. And the big question here is what's strange to me about this, Scott, is that now we have two sort of oppositional, but both kind of extreme things that might happen. And it's like, okay, let's get rid of this one legal framework entirely. And it's like, no, let's get rid of every car.
Yeah, it's pretty extreme, isn't it? You're right.
On both sides.
You're right. It actually is. It's really extreme. There's no in between. There's no gray area here, as far as they're concerned.
And I have a decent comparison, kind of from my childhood, that I'll tell you right after this break. Sorry to cliffhang on an anticlimactic story.
Oh, yeah, I'm on the edge of my chair.
All right. I'll tell you, this sort of stuff, like state-by-state banning, always makes me think of fireworks.
Really?
Yeah.
Fireworks.
Oh,
okay.
Because growing up, spending time in Georgia, the good fireworks were banned. Mm-hmm. You get sparklers or something.
Yeah, snakes.
Yeah. They were banned in Georgia. Georgia is surrounded by other states.
Oh, yeah, that have enormous fireworks warehouses.
Right, and they're all directly over the state line.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't legally get fireworks in Georgia. You could just drive for an hour or two, and then boom.
Well, it used to be that you'd have to sign something that said that you would not light them in a state that it wasn't allowed in, I believe. Something like that.
Well, you must have been going to places on the up and up.
Well, you know what? I went to – here in Michigan, the difference was you could buy them. You couldn't own them. So that's a weird rule too, is that you were able to buy them from these roadside stands in some areas. And there weren't many around, but you had to then provide them with your license number, your driver's license number. And you'd sign something that said, I'm in possession of these, but I'm not going to light them in this state, which is a ridiculous thing to sign.
That's weird. That's a weird thing to ask people to promise.
But also, how many people did you know that, had a neighbor who was a truck driver, and they would often go through Tennessee and they would pick up, a couple of bricks of firecrackers and, some bottle rockets and, whatever else they had, M80s, and they'd bring them back to the kids in the neighborhood and distribute them. They'd sell them, probably make a profit. But, it was always somebody who was driving through those states that would do that. Did you have the same experience in your neighborhood growing up?
Yeah.
Anybody that was an enabler, a provider?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Someone that fed your habit?
Yes, someone who kept me hooked up to the gunpowder smack. That's what we called it.
Ben, this is reminding me of something. I don't know how I'm thinking about this right now, but were you when you were younger? Did you watch The Price is Right ever, or any of the game shows? I guess that would give away a car occasionally.
Yeah, I saw parts of it.
All right, I feel like we've discussed this years ago on this podcast, but it seems to me that every time they would give that away, of course, a lot of these game shows were coming from California, right? They were on the West Coast. And a lot of times they would say, you know, here's a 1981 Toyota Celica GT with California emissions. And they would always mention California emissions in the description of the vehicle.
Uh-huh.
And that was probably the first time, you know, I'm in Indiana or something, and I'm thinking, what the heck is California emissions? Why is it different for every, you know, for every car built in California?
Yeah.
And it turns out, you know, manufacturers had to increase or had to change or modify, alter in some way the vehicles that went to California, that were shipped to California, because they had stricter emissions controls than every other state. And now I guess nine states have joined in. So it's not just California that have jumped on the 1970 Clean Air Act bandwagon with them. You know, the CARB restrictions, I guess.
It's Georgia is one. Pennsylvania is another, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's more than just Pennsylvania and Georgia, though, right?
Yeah, I think there's around nine. There might be more at this point, but I think it's around nine. So, you know, I don't know if we want to say they jumped on the bandwagon or not, but, you know, they're on board with the California emissions thing now. So you can't just say California emissions.
No.
I guess not. And I haven't watched a game show in a long time.
And maybe the plan is one day for those California emissions to just be emissions in general.
Just emissions.
Yeah. Just like in France, they're just called fries. No, I'm kidding. That's not true. And if we have any Belgium based listeners, apparently the Belgians claim to have invented French fries. Do you know that?
No, I did not know that.
They don't call them French fries.
No.
I don't know what they call them.
No, I guess – I don't know. I guess they don't call them freedom fries.
Yeah, make up a name for them.
Whatever happened to that trend, freedom fries? That's gone. Oh, well.
I guess it just took longer to say it. You know, if you're hungry, you don't want to waste the time.
So you don't know what we're talking about, look it up. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a weird one. Let's do a little bit of a thought experiment here, man.
All right.
Let's say that this does go through, right?
Yeah.
That they being the government of California, do put in on the books a plan to remove all combustion engines. First, we have to think of a couple of immediate questions that spring to mind. Does that mean preventing, similar to the UK, does that mean preventing the sale of new IC cars? Or does that also factor in taking the used cars off the market?
Well, to me, it seems that right now it'd have to be restricting the sale of new vehicles, because you can't register a new vehicle without going through, you know, a government agency of some sort, a state agency of some sort.
So there's a gate there.
Yeah, that's the gate. And they're saying, well, sorry, if it's not an EV or a hybrid, as you said, if it's a straight combustion powered engine, it is something that we're not going to register this vehicle for use in the state. Now, if you were to have one already and you had to go back and register again, I wonder if they were going to have – well, of course, you'd have to be grandfathered in, because they can't expect everybody to buy a new car within a year.
Right.
That's something – and even when they phase out helmet laws or something like that, there's a window where, you know, if you don't have one, you've got 6 years to get one. You know, and a helmet's $100 or whatever. You got 6 years to save up $100 to get a helmet.
Which means if they want to hit something in the next decades, you know, anywhere from starting 2030 to 2050,
yeah,
they're going to need to make those laws quickly.
Well, my helmet, you know, example is a little bit silly. And I know that the dollar amount is probably a little low. It's probably more like $300-$400 for a good helmet. But to get a car, I mean, to get an all-new car, you know, with a new powertrain, for a lot of people, that's a pretty tall order. And even in, as you said, you know, a decade or so,
right,
I still feel like that's a pretty short ramp-up time for something like this.
An average, not embarrassing to drive, but not super impressive IC sedan is what, a little over $32,000?
Yeah, I think it's above that at this point, north of there somewhere.
It's north of there.
Yeah.
It's not 40 yet, but it's north of 32.
Yeah, and and here's the other thing. If we're talking about an alternative drivetrain vehicle, you know, something that has hybrid or, you know, a
sure,
fuel cell, or, you know, whether it's an all-electric vehicle, these are more expensive vehicles to begin with. I mean, they cost more than their internal combustion counterparts, so that's going to be an issue as well.
And I'm really glad you mentioned this, because, of course, it's tempting for people to say, well, this is this economy of scale. Of course these cars are going to be more expensive because the big manufacturers just really started making them.
Mm-hmm.
with, of course, hats off and a moment of silence for Saturn's EV program.
That was a short moment of silence. I broke it with laughter.
That's fine.
Sorry.
That's probably the way Saturn would have wanted
sorry,
it.
I'm sorry, Saturn.
But the idea is valid, and on the surface it would make sense to say, well, there's going to be a huge drop in price when there are a lot more cars made, right? And when the more I don't want to say low end, I don't want to say that they're low quality, but the more affordable car manufacturers make electric versions, the problem with that is that there are other inherent cost factors in electric vehicles that don't have much wiggle room to change, and as a matter of fact, become more expensive as we build more vehicles, and especially as we build more batteries.
Yeah, now you're talking about metals, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So the production of metals, and this is something that a lot of people really don't think about. You know who does think about it, though? Investors. So
yes.
People are already investing in the precious metals that that are required to create electric vehicles. Now, I mean, just for an example, I read this somewhere, and I don't know where my note is, but I think an electric vehicle requires three times the amount of copper that a standard internal combustion powered engine requires. And that's just one example. Now think about the batteries that we were talking about for EVs. They require cobalt and lithium, copper, aluminum, nickel. They require not only those, but also some rare earth metals. Rare earth elements, I guess, that happen to be metals, that are pretty expensive at this point. And the problem, I guess, really comes down to getting those metals out of the ground fast enough. It's not that, you know, global reserves aren't there. We have the material.
Sure.
It's just it becomes a mining issue. And a lot of people don't consider the mining factor in all this.
Right. And mining companies, global mining companies, are some of the largest companies you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. You know, these companies are moving millions of tons and billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the best way to say it. And the markets are responding to this. Cobalt, for example, right? Cobalt in just 1 year in 2016, the price of cobalt rose 37%. That so far in 2017, it surged 70% on the London Metal Exchange.
Oh, man.
So if that kind of trend continues with all of the metals required for this, including the rare earth materials, then what that means is, regardless of how efficiently and inexpensively a manufacturer can make, you know, just like a bargain basement, economy-minded electric vehicle, they're still going to be paying so much for these other materials that the EV is still going to be more expensive than an IC.
Yeah, and now you're mentioning, you know, the relatively low-cost vehicle. In a moment, let's talk about the Tesla Model 3. Does that sound good?
That sounds great.
All right, so
before
we do this, before we talk about the Model 3, I want to say that I watched an interview with someone named Julia Atwood, who is she was out of London, but she was with the Bloomberg New Energy Finance Group. And she was talking about – it was an interview about the metals and do we have enough and, you know, just what's happening with the prices mainly. Because, again, Bloomberg's a financial site and they're talking about the finances. So they're talking about the spike in cobalt, as you mentioned, the spike in lithium and other metals as well. But the question came up, do we have the materials necessary for the battery production that's going to be required if they do decide to ramp up electric car production like they're talking about? Because again, right now they're just not producing the number that you would perceive they're producing based on what you hear in the press, based on what you see and hear every day, you know, in the popular media.
Right.
So for now, her answer was, for now, yes, we have even in the long term, the question isn't, do we have enough global reserves? The question is, you know, how again do we ramp up the mining production? How do we get the demand, you know, for you know, the cobalt and the copper and the lithium and all that. How do we get that demand to match the amount that, or I shouldn't say demand to match. We should say, how do we get the production to match the demand for EVs, I guess, if that happens? You know, if people are demanding EVs, let's say even by the mid-2020s, there are going to be some bottlenecks. You know, there are going to be some production bottlenecks that will occur that where, you know, supplies simply won't be there. And she makes a point by saying, you know, by 2030, just to supply the EV market alone, that means lithium production would have to increase by 300%, you know, based on the numbers that we have today. So 300% increase by 2030, and that's kind of difficult to do. That's a total production, for, you know, that's total production for everything. I mean, you know, all types of lithium batteries that we require, not just EVs, but and oh, hang on, that is just for EVs. That's just the EV market, rather. And cobalt production would have to increase by something like 127%. So there's going to be nothing but more demand for these metals as time goes on. If the market still wants EVs as we predict that they will, you know, in the next 10 years or so, 10, 15 right. years maybe. So really, I mean, you're banking on the idea that it's going to continue this ramp up, really. And that's pretty much the thrust of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, of course, automobile companies, they have to understand that there's a major, massive technical shift ahead of them. You know, they have to do things differently. And, of course, you know, with the price going up and everything, that they're finding it difficult right now to invest in that when they're not seeing the sales numbers that they were hoping to see out of the vehicles at this point. I think that, you know, they were well, maybe not hoping to see. Let's put it a different way, because as Fiat CEO said, you know, he loses money every time one goes out the door, but they're still having to produce the vehicles in order to stay competitive in the marketplace. And by the way, China is said to have a monopoly on the rare earth elements, but that's not necessarily true. There are other mines around. In fact, there's one in America called the Molycorp Mine or Mining Corporation or something like that, and Lynas Corporation in Australia. I hope I didn't get the Molycorp name too wrong, but Molycorp and Lynas, and again in Australia. And that Forbes article that I was telling you about, it kind of dispels the idea that China has a monopoly on this area, these rare earth elements. And by rare earth, we've said this a few times now, but
right.
There's about 17 elements that are considered rare earth, and most of those are metals, I believe. Mm-hmm. Things like scandium and lanthanum. There's cerium, there's neodymium, there's a bunch of them.
Europium, yeah.
Yeah, there's a huge list of them. But the truth is that right now the U.S. and Australia are producing more than 10% of the global the current global consumption of those rare earth metals and elements. So, you know, we're kind of holding our own, I guess. China does not have a complete monopoly on the rare earth metals.
No, but in 2010, based mostly on their resources in Mongolia, they were producing a lot, but they have smaller proven reserves.
Yeah.
And also this can be this can have environmental ramifications depending on how people extract the materials.
Oh, sure. And it might take years, you know, to get this, I guess, ramp up, you know, complete it. I think someone said, and I'm missing my note for this, but it might take a new mine, it might take them between 2 and 15 years to even begin production. So, you know, if your answer is to just start, you know, a new mine right now, well, you're looking at, if you started it today, you might have to wait 2 to 15 years in order to get any kind of any kind of volume out of that mine and any kind of profit, I guess, to come out of that area. And the last little bit that I want to mention here about price is she was asked again. This is Julia Atwood. She was asked for now, how does a spike in these metal prices affect the price of batteries? Because you would think that, you know, while the production numbers of the cars aren't necessarily going up, maybe a little bit, you know, the price of the metals is going up. And what does that do to the cost of the batteries that go into these vehicles? And she said that in short, it's really not going to matter a lot. The metals in the batteries are really only present in a very small amount. So, you know, you think that, you know, a price spike like what you've talked about for cobalt and for lithium would have a tremendous effect on a battery price. But the problem is, or the good thing is really, is that, you know, they've done some analysis on this and they say the price of lithium, even if it quadrupled, would only raise the price of a battery by about 2%, in the overall price. So, it's not a tremendous increase. So, because it's such a small amount again. And the price of cobalt, however, has a little bit more of an effect, but I'll tell you that it doesn't really matter in a second, because even if that metal doubled or tripled in price, it's still it would increase the price of a battery by less than 10%, and everything else that goes into a battery right now is dropping in price so much, so fast, that it would probably just be completely absorbed, you know, in the cost of the battery as a whole. So, don't look at the price spike right now as a contributing factor to battery price. It's just not working out that way.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point there. You also have to wonder what the fate of used IC cars would be, you know, as they're getting out of the grandfathered in phase. Because California is home to a lot of classic cars.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true. A lot that people wouldn't want to let go of. Of course. I mean, people don't want to let go of their daily driver, you know, if it's an internal combustion engine. It's a tough thing to do. I mean, a lot of people just simply – I mean, believe it or not, a lot of people still aren't buying into the electric car thing. I mean, I get it. I understand, because it doesn't meet everybody's needs. They're not for – everyone. I mean, we've talked many times about, you know, who it works for and who it doesn't work for. And for a lot of the United States, it doesn't work. You know, unless you're in a congested metropolitan area, an EV or even a hybrid in some cases, well, I guess maybe a hybrid a little less, but an EV has a limited number of people that it really fits with, you know, people that really could use one.
Right, currently.
And I know that Tesla has kind of broken that model a little bit, because remember when we first started talking about these cars, back when we started the show, what was that, 2008 or something like that? It was a long time ago. We were talking about cars that had ranges in, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles maybe at the most. I think the greatest range was one that was like 80 miles. And now we're talking about cars that have, you know, 250 miles range. So that opens the market quite a bit, you know, for people that can use one. So it's not necessarily just a city commuter car anymore. It does appeal to a few more people, but anybody that's going to be making a cross-country trip, you know, that they know that it's just difficult. Once you get outside of the coasts, I think, and the major centers, you know, the major cities, you have a hard time finding the infrastructure to allow a trip like that to happen. And not only that, it adds so much time when you have to, stop to charge your vehicle for 4 or 5 or 6 hours. That doesn't necessarily play into a smooth or quick road trip for somebody.
Right.
It's difficult.
And then there are other places where an EV makes sense. Like, just like you said, Scott, in densely populated, generally smaller areas, by which I mean areas with less distance between point A and point B. So like a lot of areas in Europe would be great for this.
Yeah. And I mean, okay, we mentioned the long charging times, right?
Right.
Also, I mean, you got to think about this too. A lot of people would be would have a harder time, I guess, maybe charging their car, you know, in a public location rather than, you know, pulling it into their own garage and, you know, where they have a dedicated charger installed. Not everybody has that, you know, ability to do that. They don't have the place to do it. They don't have a garage that can be locked up. They don't have a place that they feel secure about leaving the car overnight while it's charging. That's also an issue. There's also the factor of low gasoline prices. You know, oftentimes we'll see a spike in electric vehicle sales when gasoline prices go up to, you know, $4 or $5 a gallon. But right now, I mean, and for a long time, gasoline prices have been low again, and people have been buying trucks and SUVs and bigger cars. So, it kind of depends on the market as well. So, I don't know. It just seems like, you know what? One more thing I wanted to mention here, and this is also from that Quick Take article, on the Tesla Model 3 that we'll talk about. California regulators recently reported, this is just in January, that more than three quarters of survey respondents had yet to seriously consider a plug-in vehicle. That's California.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying that three quarters of the survey respondents had yet to seriously consider a plug-in electric car. I mean, that doesn't match up with what you're hearing in the media. That sounds like,
right.
It seems like everybody out there on the West Coast is driving an electric vehicle. And I know that's not true, but three quarters haven't even considered it yet. So the sales numbers just aren't necessarily exactly what we're hearing, again, in the popular media. Now, Ben, I think we should maybe take a little bit of a break here and come back, and we'll talk about the Tesla Model 3. How's that sound?
Perfect. We're back. We're back to take a closer look at one of the newer projects from Old Muskie.
Old Muskie. All right, so
I'm kidding. No one has called him that. From Elon Musk and Tesla.
Yeah, so we're talking about the Model 3, right? And this is the I guess the cheaper, or I should say more affordable Tesla, right? And it still comes in around $35,000, which is pretty decent.
Not too bad.
0 to 60 in under 6 seconds, and it's got a range of something like 215 miles per charge, so not bad. And I believe that at the introduction of this vehicle, you know, when he came out and did they said it was kind of like a press conference almost like Apple would have. You
exactly.
Know, like, he came out and kind of grandstanded the vehicle a bit and told all the features and everything, and it's kind of neat what he's doing. He's a showman. And he took 325,000 orders for the Tesla Model 3. Now that's with a $1,000 deposit for each one of those. So he's got an order of 325,000. And here, there's a problem with that though, Ben.
What's that?
Now, the problem is that, and most people probably don't realize this, but Tesla is not right now considered a mass producer of automobiles. And you'd never guess that because you see Teslas everywhere, at least we do here in the Atlanta area. And I would bet that in states that have, you know, these retail locations that you see a lot of Teslas around.
It's all over the news.
Yeah.
Tesla's pretty active in California. As a matter of fact, just this past week off the air, there were some Tesla representatives with a Model X that would just take it to our office every day, not like here physically in the studio, but take it to the premises of this building and just like show it off to people.
Yeah, display it, right?
Just, display it.
Because a lot of people don't get a hands-on experience with a Tesla unless you know somebody that owns one. So, you know, it's a good opportunity, right? Well, the thing is, again, they're not a mass producer of automobiles, and there's a big, big difference between building, let's say, you know, tens of thousands of vehicles, which they do now, and let's say building 300,000 or more vehicles in 1 year. That's really, really difficult. So I hadn't really thought about this. I hadn't thought about all the things that would be necessary to ramp up production like that. But, I mean, we're talking about ramping up five times the annual sales volume that it currently has, so it currently delivers. So what's going to have to happen is they're going to have to speed up production. They're going to have more people. There's going to be, you know, more stations on the assembly line, you know, so it's going to be more people doing, you know, a smaller part of the job than right now. They've got less people doing more on the vehicle. And it's also going to be a lot more complicated and mistakes are going to happen along the way. And the thing is that with that type of production, that level of production, you know, that number that we're talking about, the frequency and the consequences are going to be greater as you ramp up that production, as you get, you know, the bigger and bigger numbers. So it's really going to get difficult. I mean, it's not something that should be taken very lightly. And I know Tesla isn't taking it very lightly.
No.
But the question is, though, I've seen this a few places, that they're talking about where he's going to do this. Like how is he going to make, you know, the current assembly line work, if he can make the assembly line work? And I don't think they can. They're going to have new, you know, tooling in place.
Okay.
He's skipping the pilot, stage of this whole thing. So he's going right into full production, which is a gamble to begin with.
Sure.
Because a lot of the mistakes are figured out in the, you know, the pilot program, where they build a car on a mock assembly line. They do it kind of slowly, but, you know, they make sure that everything fits right and everything works right. And then they do it on a larger scale for the actual production vehicle. And all that pilot tooling is then just scrapped or, you know, used again somewhere else. But it's expensive to do that. And he's skipping that process in order, you know, for money and for speed, I believe. And so that's one thing. They're talking about, you know, where is he going to do this? Because, you know, they can't figure out where the production facility will be. The Bay Area, you know, San Francisco is not necessarily known as a blue collar manufacturing area. You know, it's more white collar, you know, software developers and things like that.
Right.
Know, professional, office jobs. So they're saying, well, he may take it somewhere else, but would it even be in the United States? Because he's been offered locations in, I want to say France has offered him a location. Mm-hmm. I don't know where else in the world he's been offered, you know, property that was at one time manufacturing, you know, has changed, you know, so it's massive amounts of land available.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if he would take it, you know, overseas, or would it remain in the United States? It seems like it would remain a U.S. company, but I'm not sure. You know, once the numbers come out about what it costs to build a vehicle like this, and again, you know, there's this trade-off, this balance where, you know, you have to invest so much in order to develop car or to build cars this quick. You know, all the stuff I talked about, more people, a bigger facility, you know, faster production, you know, five times the volume that you're currently doing. Once you start doing that, and the cars are considerably less than the cars that he's producing now. So, you know, I think we saw this, and I read this somewhere. Again, it's lost in my notes, as everything is. They said that Mercedes kind of learned this when they purchased Chrysler, when it became Daimler Chrysler.
Uh-huh.
And they found out that it's a lot different when you're making a smaller number of, you know, luxury or, you know, luxury and high-performance automobiles versus when you're trying to make, you know, car, like a huge number of cars for the mass market. It's a different prospect altogether.
Yeah.
And they learned a lesson there. They learned you can't easily do both. I mean, you can do them separately, but you can't do them together in the same way. And that's a problem that I think that Tesla's going to find out is that, or that Elon Musk is going to find out that, you know, and he, I'm sure he knows this, you know, all the investigative work that goes into
sure.
you know, coming up with these ideas. You know, he's got to have advisors that are telling him all this, but it's tough to manufacture a lot of vehicles at a lower price. It's tougher to do that than it is to manufacture a smaller number of vehicles at a higher price.
Yes, absolutely agreed. That's why economy of scale is something that if you look over automotive history, very few car companies actually achieve.
Yeah.
It's just a simple matter of the attrition level here, like especially in the early days of automotive manufacturing, man. There are hundreds of car companies you've never heard of that went belly up quickly because they were facing the same kind of problem. Now, Tesla is a smart company. It's already gone much further than many people thought it would, but the investors are all watching this rollout of the Model 3. Also, I have a funny Model 3 story for you.
Okay, what is it?
Okay. So, you know, we've covered Tesla in the past here, so you know there's the Model S, there's the Model X.
Yeah.
Elon Musk originally wanted the Model 3 to be the Model E because, true story, he wanted them to spell sex.
Oh, come on.
I'm telling you, man, I thought it was a rumor. It is not a rumor. He's like on record saying like, yes, I think it would be cool if they – it's like the most human thing this weird, brilliant, maybe supervillain has ever done.
Where does the Roadster come in on this then, I wonder? Oh, it's topless.
That's pretty good, man.
Yes, yeah, hey.
Hey.
I don't know. Well,
you're out here, you know, you're working live. Sometimes you hit gold.
I try. And it's still PG, by the way.
And it is still PG. So the thing is, like, in particular, there's an analyst group over at a place called Bernstein, and they think that Tesla is spending so much cash on this thing that it's inevitably going to run out of money. But then other people are saying, no, this is how you're supposed to play the game for high growth companies, mm-hmm. right? But there's no two ways around it. This is a real doubling down.
It feels to me like this is Tesla's sink or swim moment, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, it really does feel like that. I know there have been other moments along the way, but I mean, this is maybe the latest sink or swim moment because, you know, the company's done tremendous. It made tremendous inroads, I guess, with at least the U.S. auto buying market. I don't know how it's doing worldwide, but it is definitely a powerhouse, I think, in the electric vehicle market or electric vehicle arena. It's the one that we see probably the most of around here. I mean, maybe the Nissan Leaf, we see a lot of those around. There's a ton of Leafs.
That's true.
But for an all EV vehicle, Tesla is a close second. Mm-hmm. And we see a ton of them, both the Model X and the Model S right now. I'm guessing that we'll see a lot of Model 3s when that comes out. But I think that also has something to do with the availability of the vehicle here. You know, you can get them here. You can get them serviced here. I've seen service centers
True.
Around too.
Yeah.
Separate, you know, buildings for that. But, you know, I don't think that's something that is nationwide true. I think that they have less than 100 locations across the United States or right around 100 locations
right.
across the entire United States. And I believe that those are in maybe about half of the states right now, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, a lot of people would have to drive you know, hours and hours to even get to see one, you know, in their mall locations or whatever they have, you know, like, mm-hmm. it's not a kiosk at the mall, but it's close. It's just a, mm-hmm. you know, small storefront. So a lot of people just haven't, some people haven't even seen them yet. I mean, it's just the reality. But again, here in, you know, a major metropolitan center like what we have and what probably a lot of our listeners are in, you know, if you're in San Francisco, if you're in New York or, mm-hmm. you know, Chicago, wherever, I bet you've seen a lot of Teslas. But that might not necessarily be the truth across all of the United States or especially, well, all of North America even.
So here's the question. I got to ask. I think we've done an okay job looking at the situation, the proposals by the governor of California.
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you a question. I think we've done a pretty good job sort of outlining the big picture, right?
I think so.
So California and especially its governor really want to ban IC cars.
Sure.
And we've also shown that there's a global trend in some other countries. But neither of us have really answered this question on air yet. Do you think this will work?
Do I think it will work?
Do you think it will happen? Do you think it'll work?
No, I don't think it'll work. I think there's going to be enough pushback on this that it's not going to go through. I don't think that, and also, you know, the other thing is like, well, if you're going to ban the on-road transportation, you know, if you're going to restrict everybody in this way,
sure.
Why would you not target, you know, some of the bigger probably pollutants, I guess. And I don't have any studies right now in front of me to back this up, but lawn equipment and ATVs and, you know, the other stuff that people use that use internal combustion engines, especially the two-stroke vehicles that burn oil with the gas at the same time.
Oh, yeah. What about cargo ships?
Yeah, cargo ships.
What about cargo ships that hit the ports in California?
Yeah, exactly.
Are they going to – I don't think you can make an EV cargo ship
I don't think
that size.
I don't think so
yet.
Either. And yet. And I don't know. Even yeah, like you said, boats, you know, even if it's a recreation, you know, personal boats, personal watercraft. There's just so many other – vehicles that use internal combustion that I don't know if this is going to make much of an impact and if people are going to go for it. I mean, when you're saying like, well, if China can do it, we can do it. I don't know if that's a good enough argument, for most people. And now I know that there's some people that's perfectly fine for, but I don't feel like this isn't something that if I was there, I would push against this very hard.
I think that at heart, it is a good concept, and I do think that businesses and governments play an important role in encouraging the evolution of technology, right? Mm-hmm. But also, we've seen multiple times – I know people can argue back and forth on this, but we've seen multiple times that when – there is an overarching authority that mandates something from the top down to, you know, the average Jane and John Doe voters, right? People tend not to react well to that, especially if they feel like what they already have is working, you know? Another example of this, I remember talking about it with our friend and sometimes guest, Jonathan Strickland, on his show, Tech Stuff. We talked about 3D televisions. Do you remember these, Scott?
Yeah, I do.
So a few years back, a bunch of television manufacturers said, we have decided that home 3D television will be the new thing that everybody's into. And they put out a lot of expensive TVs, some of which required you to wear special proprietary glasses, some of which had very specific rules about where you should sit distance to or from television. Mm-hmm. And almost universally, these all flopped because it turned out that it didn't matter if the technology was objectively better. It mattered what the customers wanted. And in this case, I think this can work. I think this could be a good move, but only if the people of California actually want it to happen and there are compelling financial reasons. Look, this is not – at this point, I'm not even looking at this as a a matter of saving, helping, or harming the environment. I'm looking at the likelihood of people to go along with this, mm-hmm. right? If it happens and you and I and our super producer, Casey, are three guys in California looking for cars, right?
Yeah.
First off, we're probably going to end up buying, unless there are amazing tax credits, we're probably going to end up buying a used IC car.
Yeah.
Because that's like reliable, it's fairly predictable, and it's probably cheaper.
Yeah. It's within our range.
It's within the range. And with the other likely price complications, right? Like there would probably be more incentives, at least on the California level, mm-hmm. to get an electric vehicle or a hybrid. And there would probably be a dip in cost for some EVs, some new models of EVs coming out. But depending on how the mining goes, that could be a very temporary dip.
Could be.
And then eventually, if they stuck to their guns with it, as cars aged out and there were more used EVs. See, that's what I feel like would be the crucial tipping point, is when there would be a large enough population of used electric vehicles that people could buy and that would operate reliably. Mm-hmm. And right now, I don't know if we're there. And
no.
I don't know how long it takes to get there.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's – I mean, if you look through the classifieds in any state, any city, it seems like the majority of vehicles are still internal combustion engines that are listed as used vehicles. And the ones on the lots are still IC-powered. So, yeah, you're right. There's a disparity in the amount of EVs that are available as used vehicles compared to – the standard cars, I guess, the cars that, you know, we all know from decades past. But yeah, I one thing I want to make clear here is I wasn't saying, you know, don't be a good, steward of the earth? Is that what they say? You know,
yeah.
Of course, keep it clean, of course, but, we're not talking about, I don't think we're talking here about, even with California's proposal, we're not talking about completely removing gas from the equation. We're talking about just lessening, you know, the amount that we need or the oil that we need. I think it's just a reduction in, a reduction in the amount of engines that are out there, you know, spewing out the carbon dioxide.
Right.
So it's not completely eliminating them. It's just reducing them.
And I think that's a very good point. You know, large groups of people in large industries are just like changing their direction is like changing the direction of a large vehicle.
Yeah.
You got to turn wide and slow.
Well, we've said this is decades away. And I think that, you know, even if this happens in 2050 – I mean, I'm going to be 80 years old, Ben, when this happens, if it does happen. Or if it happens in 2040, you know, so 70 years old, I'm still driving probably. We're talking about something that's that far away.
Yeah.
It's something that's probably going to affect our kids. You know, that's the way that I look at it. Again, a slow ramp up for this. And like you said, a slow turn, mm-hmm. you know, slow turn of a cargo ship or whatever you want.
Slow and wide, my friend.
That's how you have to do it because there's just no way you can force something like this on people overnight.
Now, I gotta say, would I be happy living in an area where the majority of vehicles were electric? Yeah, I'd be fine with it.
Yeah, why not?
I wouldn't have a problem with it, but I don't. While I agree with the noble intentions of doing this sort of stuff, and while I do think that these alternative forms of energy are going to be increasingly large players in the field and maybe even one day dominate the field. Mm-hmm. It's tough for me to see how this plan would work out well in the short term for the average Californian. Mm-hmm. And of course there are entrenched interests, right? Like the big three aren't necessarily falling all over themselves to stop being able to sell the majority of their offerings, right?
Yeah.
But I think it is a little bit more reasonable to aim for some foot in the door, kind of slow escalation, reduce emissions, telling people what they can't buy is – okay, I'm going to say it. I don't mean this to be controversial. it's kind of like prohibition. It's prohibition of internal combustion engines, internal combustion powered cars,
yeah,
because of their effects, which are real, on the environment.
So what if people had bootleg IC engines in their car?
Yeah.
And let's say that they hid the tailpipe underneath the vehicle so you can't see it from the outside.
Uh-huh.
You place an EV sticker on the back and then you or a decal or whatever, and then you muffle it down to the point where you can't hear the engine running. But you're still burning gas. But where would you get your bootleg gas from? That's a problem. I guess you'd have to go down to the marina and pick it up, right?
This is getting really complicated.
Go down to the marina and pick it up, but it would be more expensive.
It would. You'd be paying a premium. But then also people like racing would change,
yeah,
right? It might attract a more dangerous element because it's underground, where there would be like speakeasies for cars with engines. I read a long time ago a sci-fi story that addressed this same thing. It was like this utopian near future society where things were much more strictly and clearly mandated or forbidden, and it's all a mystery. I know this is going to sound weird, but it was a great read. It was all this mystery about this investigator who was trying to track down some murders. And then found out, spoiler, I'm being vague enough that it doesn't matter if it's spoiler, and then found out that the person who was responsible for the murders was like an engineer in monitoring the city's emissions and had been covering up the fact that he was driving like this illegal internal combustion car. It was a very weird twist. It was very well written. I don't want to live in that kind of future.
No. I don't either. I don't either, where it becomes like an illegal prospect to take your IC-powered vehicle out for, you know, a drive in the mountains or something like that. That would be terrible. But, you know, who knows? Maybe we're getting to that point. It seems like could be decades and decades away, but it seems like there's a push, a move, a genuine tidal shift to get there. And it's happening. It's happening around the world. It's happening here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're seeing it. It's happening right now. It could be in our lifetime. It could be just after our lifetime. Who knows? But the trend
Speak for
is
yourself, man.
Well, I'm a lot older than you, so maybe this will affect you more than me.
I want to be one of those people who just keeps like adding mechanical parts to myself as the other ones peter out. You know what I mean?
You'd be a biomechanical. Oh, there's a term for that. I can't remember.
Cyborg?
Maybe. I don't know.
Oh, but I'll have to be EV. Cyborg, right?
I guess you're
right.
I
can't take gas.
Nope. No gas, no oil.
But look, at this point, you know, this is all speculation. We've provided some of the possible complications that a lot of people don't think about, which would be, of course, mining and finding the necessary materials for this is one of the biggest ones. It also, you know, it calls to mind this old episode that we did a while back, which was about – it asked how much money are you really saving on a hybrid, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And what are the net benefits of a hybrid? Yeah. And we found something that doesn't occur to a lot of people. When you're driving an EV – you might still be polluting the environment because it depends on where that electricity comes from,
mm-hmm.
you know. And here in Georgia, for instance, a lot of coal plants.
Sure.
Right? So you're really – if you're driving a hybrid in Georgia and you're charging it in Georgia, you're driving a coal-powered vehicle and you're just not seeing the smoke.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And of course, manufacturing as
and
well.
And of course, manufacturing.
I mean, that all plays into it, you know, how it's manufactured. I think we also did a delve into, is it worth it to buy a hybrid versus a standard vehicle?
Oh, yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
There were a couple that were equal. You know, they were both the same model. You could, you know, pay more for the hybrid up front,
mm-hmm.
but what would you have to pay for fuel in the other vehicle, in that vehicle?
And over time, when would it
equal out?
Yeah.
And that was a staggering.
It's a long time.
Staggering number.
Yeah. Now that number will get lower as, this technology improves. And to be honest, like I know I might sound like I'm dumping on EVs or hybrids. I'm not. There are some awesome ones out there, and I would love to. I would love to take a Tesla for a spin.
Oh, there's some amazing electric vehicles out there. Don't get us wrong. We like them a lot. It's just I don't know if we want to go completely that direction at this point.
And again, I understand the motivation. Ecologically speaking, a lot of places on this planet are like a dumpster fire right now.
Absolutely need EVs or just less internal combustion engines.
Right, right.
You know, some restrictions of some kind. I mean, there's got to be something done because, I mean, it's choking you when you go outside.
Like it is inspiring that China is so aggressively and assertively pursuing alternative methods of energy production. But part of that, the primary part of that is out of necessity.
Do you remember seeing the pictures out of Beijing before the Olympics?
Yeah.
It looked like smog continuous. I mean, 24 hours a day. So thick that you couldn't see through it even. So, and they've really done a lot to cut that down. I mean, it's been reduced. I don't know. Maybe it's come back now. I don't know. Maybe it was just, cleaning up for the Olympics. But it was a problem. It's a big problem. And it was like that in California at one time. So they've done a tremendous job in bringing that back down. Look at some old photos of California back in the days before, you know, the Clean Air Act. Some of them are, again, shocking. It looks like, you know, a cloud that's hovering over the city, or it's in the city. Mm-hmm. And again, some of these old black and white photographs you can find from that time are just, they're shocking to see. So they've done a pretty good job of this, and they're trying to do even better. And I guess if this is the way that they think they can do it, and they're not going to, you know, face any kind of opposition, I guess, if they're not going to. I think they will.
Yeah, I
think there's going to be a lot of pushback on this.
Also, this would count agricultural vehicles, Scott. Think about that.
Oh, it's true, like, yeah.
And they've ton of agriculture in California.
Huge ranches out there, too. Yeah. I mean, cattle ranches that require, you know, vehicles to get, you know, all around the ranch, all the equipment that they need.
Is it possible that we would live in a future where, like, say you and Casey and I went on a road trip again? Is it possible that we would get turned away at the border of California for having the wrong vehicle?
There's a chance, I think, that from what they're talking about, they might restrict you to certain roads. You might not be allowed to travel on the highways. So that's one of the things. Remember registration, new vehicle registration, possibly restricting, where you can travel or how you can travel, I guess. Kind of like the way that they police the multi-passenger lanes right now, the carpool lanes. They might be able to do that. I don't know. Strange. It's a weird thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
But as always, like we like to say every time, this is really just a starting point for your investigation. If you want to jump into this and read about it, because you can find all the legislation that they're proposing and all the people that are talking about this and what they're saying and why they want it to happen, and also dig into what's happening around the world. Because again, China, Norway, India, the UK, France, there's a lot of places that are doing this and a lot of manufacturers that are doing this as well. So it's an interesting trend. We'll see how it turns out.
And of course, you can find the other shows we mentioned at our website, carstuffshow.com. Yes, we want to hear what you think. Do you own an EV or a hybrid? Are you for this or against it, and why? Hopefully we've outlined the pros and cons of both sides.
Yeah, we tried.
We did something.
we did something for this hour.
Welcome to Car Stuff. Yeah. We did something. And we will be back next week. In the meantime, you can find more Car Stuff on Twitter and Facebook, where we're Car Stuff HSW. I want to give a shout out to the people who have decided to keep sending me Honda Odyssey pictures on Twitter. I appreciate your efforts so far. I'm not into any of them, but I do appreciate the people trying to convert me. So
you're talking about the hot rodded Odysseys, right?
Yeah. So shout out to Jonathan for sending that. And let's see, shout out to Jay. Jay sent this really great Subaru Brat. And then, shout out to Cole Chambers for pointing out using the Odyssey headlights in conversions. Mm. And if you have an idea that you think your fellow listeners would enjoy, we'd love to hear that too. You can email us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.